Shrink Wrap Radio number 659, The Self-Help Addict with business guru Daniel Geffen.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Daniel Geffen, podcaster and author of The Self-Help Addict, Turn an Overdose of Information into a Life of Transformation. For more information about Daniel Geffen, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Daniel Geffen, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
Now, I'm under the impression that you're an American living in Israel. Am I right?
You're almost right. Almost.
Okay. How did I miss it?
Well, I am living in Israel, but I'm not American. I'm British.
That would explain the accent.
Yes.
That was going to be my next question.
Yes.
Yeah.
I married an American. I have American kids.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I knew there was some kind of an American angle in there somewhere. So what's the story about living in Israel? Just quickly.
Let's see. I'm Jewish. I'm Orthodox Jewish. And I always wanted to retire here. And one day I kind of said to my wife, I don't like the idea of waiting to retire somewhere. If you really want to go somewhere, I think you should just do it. Don't wait to do it. So that's it. We did it. Here we are. So we moved all of our kids over here.
And how long, how long have you been there now?
4 years now.
Okay, great. Well, we're going to be discussing your book, The Self-Help Addict, An Overdose of Information into a Life of Transformation. But before we get into that, tell us a bit about your personal story. We've already gotten into that a little bit, but tell us more.
What part do you want to know? Because there's so much, there's so many things. I mean, I could start with my being in high school and being the class clown in the class, jumping on tables, trying to get attention. I basically craved attention. So I would do anything I could to get it. And I actually thought that the people, you know, students in the class were laughing with me and enjoying the entertainment. But one day I woke up and realized actually they were laughing at me, not with me. And so I was their little monkey to entertain them.
How did you come to realize that?
I've always been very, very self-aware. I do a lot of introspection, maybe sometimes too much. And so, you know, there was that, I guess that voice that suddenly appeared at I don't know what age, that suddenly became the observer. Mm-hmm. I used to think that there were two parts of me, but really there are three.
And they are?
Well, there's the sort of the good voice, so to speak, and bad voice that, you know, and the third is actually the observer that observes both and becomes almost like the negotiator, if you will, the person in between the two. I think when I say good and bad, it's not really good and bad. That's a mistake. It's more spiritual and material, if we're allowed to go there. Are we allowed to go there?
We can go wherever we want to go.
Okay.
That's the beauty of podcasting.
Right. Well, so actually the thing is that when we're young, we're told that, you know, spiritual pursuits are good and pure material pursuits are bad. But actually, as we mature, we realize that the physical needs the spiritual, the spiritual needs the physical.
Okay. It's
supposed to work together. So this observer is really... that voice or that conscience that basically says, stop bullying the material part of you because you need him.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I can understand that wrestling match back and forth. That kind of dynamic. Now, the title of the book, as I mentioned, is The Self-Help Addict. So were you a self-help addict?
Well, I am still a self-help addict.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I think the addiction is still there, but because I'm aware of it, so I avoid it when I can. So I stop myself when I'm doing it, and I'm able to pull back from it. So, in fact, it played out today, and I stopped myself.
Yeah.
Well, I was I was looking at training some of my virtual assistants, and so I was putting together a process. And one of the tools that are on the internet for creating this process is something called Process Street. And so I went to this website, and suddenly I started reading their blog. And on the blog, it started, talking about some other thing that had nothing really to do with, what I was doing. And so I found myself getting sucked in to this whole, learning and trying to get more information, which is the information overload, which I talk about in the book. And so I stopped myself realizing, okay, no, you're getting pulled in again. Go back to what you're doing. But in the past, I would go for hours, days, whatever,
It kind of reminds me of when I was getting into podcasting. I started in 2005, kind of the year the podcasting per se was born. But I wasn't the first person. And I wasted a lot of time getting ready, trying to develop a website and figure it all out. And finally, a friend of mine said to me, David, just start doing it. Just do it. And that sort of that kick in the seat of my pants was very helpful. So I can relate to that part of your story. Now, I have the impression from the book that, and also by the fact that you're doing a podcast of your own in which you pick the brains of entrepreneurs, people who are extremely successful in business. So say a bit about that side of yourself. I mean, I'm curious about that side of yourself. Where in your personal story does that come in? And do you feel like you were born with it? Did you have role models in your family?
Well, I've the creative side of me that wants to constantly express, right? And in fact, going back to sort of high school where I wanted attention, it wasn't just that I wanted attention, but it was also that I wanted to express myself. Mm-hmm. There's a deep need. There is a deep need to express and to be creative. And school doesn't always facilitate that, right? You have to be in this classroom and you have to do this. You have to listen to, this subject, and there's no flexibility for people who are just creative and this is boring for me. I'm not interested in being here right now. I want to do something else. So that sort of desire or need to express myself creatively, it expressed itself or manifested itself through podcasting, through writing a book, through playing music, through speaking, and many other, even making money is a creative venture, right? It's which is why a lot of people, when they make lots of money, they're not happy, because it's not about making the money. There's a game, and there's cute. And it could just basically end up with you feeling more empty than you were before.
Because they weren't being driven by their heart to speak, by their heart or spirit, and were more focused on the numbers?
Yeah, because they got lost, essentially. And I think that the issue is that a lot of times we do things because we think that's what we're supposed to do, or that's what everybody else is doing, so that's what needs to be done. But actually, it's not. You know, it's interesting how many people, if you ask them, what's the most fulfilling thing you could possibly do? And they'll tell you, well, spending time with my children or spending time with my spouse. Okay, and how much time do you do that? You think about it and like, well, not very much. <Yeah. laughs> So what's going on over here? You know, on the one hand, you're telling me without any question, this is what I value the most and this is what's the most important use of my time. And yet we're going off somewhere else, chasing other things. So yeah, there's a disconnect.
I'm still sort of focused on the money-making side of you, and because I think that's a lot of what's in your book, and certainly your podcast is very focused on that.
Yes.
And so again, I'm wondering about your family. Part of my career has been in the world of market research, and I asked a couple of Jewish friends, as it happens, who seemed to be just very easy. You know, I asked one of them, well, how did you learn to make money? Well, I don't know. It's always been easy for me. How come? Well, I had an uncle who had a dry cleaning business. Another market research friend, a woman, I asked her that question. Well, my family had a store. So they kind of grew up in an environment with role models where I guess it was both sanctioned. It was okay. There were not taboos against making money. So I'm just wondering if you have any of that sort of thing going on in your background.
So I mean, what's interesting for me is my relation. I had a very unhealthy relationship with money growing up because my father was really, really anxious all the time. My memories of, my father, and he's still alive, but I'm saying growing up was just a lot of terrible, terrible anxiety around money, always worrying about how much money he has and about, he had a few shops, a few stores that he owned. And, he would always talk about how, I didn't understand because I was so young, so I didn't understand exactly what but I can tell that anytime he talked about money or about business, you can see he was just so stressed out, and it caused me anxiety and it made me feel very uncomfortable. Wow. And just to give you an example, we were once on a family vacation in Spain. We were staying in this beautiful villa with a swimming pool, the ocean and everything. Wow. It was beautiful.
Yeah.
The perfect, getaway. And I'll never forget this. We were at a restaurant and my father this is a typical thing that would happen. And he took out the menu and he just looked at the prices and he said, oh God, why is it so expensive? It's so funny. We already spent so much money on this and this. And my mother, she turned around and said, well, I'm easygoing. Let's go somewhere else. We'll go somewhere cheaper. And my father would turn around. No, we're here now. We're not going. No, forget it. Whatever. And then I'll keep complaining about the overpriced food. Now I was young, and so in my mind I was thinking, well, why are you so? I would much prefer to be on the floor eating sandwiches as long as my father's happy. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, so what that did for me was it created almost like this money's evil, money's the enemy, because money stole my father from me.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Powerfully stated. And yet it's interesting that it's as big a focus in your life now as it is. So in some way you've managed to transform your relationship with money.
Yes.
Yeah. How
well,
so?
But, Well, you know, it's almost like if you imagine someone riding a horse, then the horse is, you know, running all over the place and, you know, it's hungry, so it'll go and eat, and it wants to go to the bathroom. It basically takes the rider everywhere it wants to go. If the rider learns how to control the animal, because at the end of the day, you know, the rider is the master of the horse. And so once he learns how to control and master his horse, then the horse goes where he wants to go. It's the same thing with money. If money is the master, then you'll be thrown around like a ragged doll by money. Mm. It will take you wherever it wants to go. But if you learn to be the master of money, then money has to serve. Money will serve you, and it will have to go where you want to go and what you want to do with it. That's, I guess, a very short version of kind of how I've changed my relationship over money.
Yeah. And I'm still wondering about self-help books. To mm-hmm. what extent, I guess I've got two questions for you around that. Do you think you would have benefited from the book that you've written? And if so, at what point in your life should that book have come into your life?
So I'm a perfectionist. So my answer initially would be, it's not as good as I thought it was when I wrote it. That's my perfectionist voice speaking.
Wow. Yeah.
Right.
I appreciate your candor. I don't think that's an easy thing to say.
Well, I'm just telling you what's come to my mind straight away. That's my default sort of voice of, well, it's not that good anymore. You know, it was good when I wrote it, but now, but then I stop myself and I say, well, that's not true. You know, there's a lot of amazing things that I wrote in that book, and it was very helpful and for me at the time when I wrote it, I actually needed to write it because I needed the information that I wrote down in that book. Mm-hmm. You know, so, but yes, the answer to your question is that I definitely wish I would have read a book like that, you know, years ago. You know, I wish someone wrote it for me, which is why I wrote it. I actually wrote it for my son, for my oldest son. And I published it on his 10th birthday. And okay. I gave him the first copy, and you know, that was his gift for his 10th birthday.
Yeah,
it was also a way to keep me accountable, because I kept pushing it off. I kept procrastinating and not writing the book, even though I had this idea for 10 years to write the book. In fact, I remember sitting with a therapist 10 years ago saying to her, I have this book in my head. It's called The Self-Help Addict, and I know exactly what it's going to be about and what I want to write. And she said, well, why don't you just write it? And I said, because I am the self-help addict, so I can't write it. So it took 10 years to actually get the book out. And what got me to finally write it was a year before I published it, I was putting my son to bed. And, you know, as I was putting him to bed, I had this idea of how to keep myself accountable. And that was that I said to him, I said, oh, I want to tell you a little secret. And he said, oh, what is it? I said, I know what I'm getting you for your birthday, for your 10th birthday. He smiled and he was like, are you getting me an iPad? I said, because he's always wanting an iPad. And I just don't want my kids addicted to the iPad. So he knows I do not let iPad in the house. So I said, no, not an iPad. I'm going to give you a book. And his face dropped and he's like, a book? I don't want a book for my birthday. And I said, no. I said, no, I'm going to write a book for your birthday. I'm going to write a book and I'm going to write it for you and I'm going to give it to you. And he threw his arms around me, gave me a big hug, and he was so happy, so excited.
Oh, how reinforcing for you. What a wonderful.
And I knew in that moment that I'm writing that book. No way. No,
you
no matter what
happens. You can go back at that point. You know,
that's one of the things I talk about in the book is why don't we do things? Mm-hmm. Why is it that we set goals and we don't accomplish them? Why is it that we have certain things we want to achieve and we just don't seem to do it? What is it? And what I came to realize is it really comes down to comfort, right? What is more comfortable? So if it's more comfortable to not do something, then usually we just don't do it because we're more comfortable not doing it. But if we switch it around and we create a situation where it's more comfortable to do the thing than it is to not do it, uh-huh. Well, then suddenly now we're more inclined to do it. So for example, in my case of the book, it was the discomfort of writing the book because what are people going to think of me? I might look like an idiot. It's not going to be the way I want it, you know, et cetera, all the different right. excuses. Sure. So there was this discomfort, and the discomfort is what held me back from actually doing it. So when I created a situation of the discomfort of not keeping my word to my son and not giving him the book on his 10th birthday, that discomfort outweighed the other discomfort of actually writing it.
Yeah.
I also think you
anticipated one of my questions, which was to ask whether or not you'd ever been in therapy, and you went right there, because part of what I was hearing sounded like somebody who'd been in therapy in terms of part of that observing voice that you referred to earlier. My prejudice is to believe that in part that was either learned or honed in the process of therapy.
Yes, although I will say that most therapists I've seen were a waste of time.
Were what?
A waste of time.
A waste of time. So you saw a bunch. What was it about the therapist that you saw, and was that therapist of a certain school?
So I see a therapist now who, she's amazing. She's absolutely helped me tremendously in the last 2 years. A lot of the therapists I saw were really, I think the issue was they were really boxed into their belief. And they were too textbook style, and it uh-huh. just didn't work for me.
Yeah.
And for me, a good therapist has to be somebody break out of that box and be more of a growth mindset more than the fixed mindset, which is Carol Dweck's book. Book.
That reminds me of what you were saying in relation to school, that there was no flexibility there. So
yeah,
really
exactly.
Looking for flexibility, spontaneity.
Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think I had the total wrong mindset going into this interview about who you were going to be. So I've got to roll with that. And so did you get any training in psychology yourself? Did that motivate you to?
I tried that in school. I took psychology, but my psychology teacher wanted to throw me out the window.
Because?
And publicly stated it in front of the class, and actually asked the class if they would say anything if he threw me out the window and whether they would report him.
Were you too challenging? Were you?
Yes. Yeah. I would challenge him on his, you know, and so he didn't like to be challenged. But I've read a lot of psychology books. I've studied human nature. Very curious about how and why people do what they do. The other thing I was going to mention before about comfort and discomfort, what I also found was desire is a very big indicator as well. You know, people say I want something, so I want to lose weight, or I want to make money. I find that desire is so strong that I've come to believe that if you really want something, you would have it. And therefore, when we say I want X and we don't have it, the reason we don't have it is actually because we just don't want it enough.
Mm-hmm. Coming back to the entrepreneurial stuff, you've interviewed tons of entrepreneurs. Are there any generalizations that have emerged from that? Do you have any sort of generalizations about what you say that you've interviewed billionaires even?
Yes, actually, one billionaire gave me a one line. It was a one liner that he shared that really encapsulates everything that we've been discussing. And also my whole book, he sums it up in one line, really. Because I asked him on the show, his name's Jeff Hoffman. He is the founder of Booking.com and Priceline.com, a whole host of other companies as well. Amazing guy. One of the things I asked him, I said, Jeff, you know, there's only 2,000 billionaires in the whole world. That's incredible. What separates you from everybody else? You know, what is it that makes a billionaire? You know, what does it take to become a billionaire? And he said to me, Daniel, I'll tell you something. On my wall in my office, I have a saying, and the saying is, ideas are welcome here, but execution is worshipped. That's it. Yeah. There are so many people with so many ideas, but it's the people who actually execute on the ideas. Those are the ones that are successful.
Right, right. Do you think that's... Some people seem to have an innate... My impression is that some of the very successful entrepreneurs were very driven from the beginning, that they had an innate sense of that this is what they were going to do, this is what they needed to do. So we've got that on the one hand. On the other hand, we have self-help books and workshops and courses training people to be successful. Talk to me about that balance, if you will.
You're talking about the balance of giving information and actually creating something for yourself.
I guess I'm asking about learning and
for learning versus
some people who are just driven from the beginning and they're not particularly seeking learning or
right.
And this is a stereotype in my head. I don't know that it's true.
Yeah. Well. It's interesting because Warren Buffett reads, I think, how many? 500 books a year or something crazy. I mean, you can Google it, you know, Google how many books does Warren Buffett read, but it's a lot. It's a lot. I think most of his day he spends reading. Uh-huh. It's astounding, right? And he's, you know, a very, very, very successful, wealthy investor. I mean, the most, right? Yeah. Successful, wealthy investor. Bill Gates also consumes a lot of books. And many, many of the very successful entrepreneurs that I've interviewed are always, you know, investing in more information and learning more skills. And so I don't know if it's true to say that people who are successful are the ones that are not consuming, they're just doing. But what I will say is that the people who are not successful are the ones that are consuming, but they're not converting the information into something. And I'll give you an analogy. We all know about obesity, right? It's very clear. How does a person become obese? They eat and eat and eat and eat, and they don't exercise. Now, when you exercise, what you're doing is you're taking that food that you've consumed and you are essentially converting it into energy.
Right.
If you don't do that, that's how you become obese. If you look at someone who's obese, you can see the problem. Now, there's something that I call emotional or mental obesity. It happens up here, in here. Which is where you consume and consume and consume, but you don't convert that into something. Mm-hmm. And what happens is the same thing as an obese person. So what happens, what the symptoms of an obese person? They feel heavy. They're slow, right? It's hard for them to do things. They're out of breath, right? Someone who's mentally obese is suffering from the same symptoms in their mind, in their brain. Their brain slows down. They feel heavy. They find it hard to do things, right? But the difference is that when someone's mentally obese, you don't necessarily see it. When someone's emotionally obese, you don't see it. It's happening inside. But the same thing is happening. The problem...
I don't know what's that going on here.
You sound like a mafia man. You sound like an Italian mafia.
Yeah, right. Well, this is my voice. So are you saying that that person is mentally weighed down and not going into action because they're all in their head?
Right, right. So if you think again about an obese, physically obese person, it's a vicious cycle because the heavier you become, the harder it is to exercise. Yeah. Right? It's harder to get on that treadmill. The more you consume in your mind, the more that you're overloaded and you're heavy, and the more overwhelmed you become, the less likely it is that you're going to, you know, go and take action because you're so obese. Practical example, you go on YouTube to learn how to set up a podcast. I'm just using that because we're on a podcast, but it could be anything.
Yeah.
So you see a 10-minute clip on how to set up a podcast. You go, oh, wonderful. This is great. And you go and you click on this thing. Then they refer you to another video that they put together about this other aspect of podcasting. So you click on that video. And then you notice on the side that there's other videos from other people recommending other ways to do a podcast. And so you go, okay, well, hold on, let me see what this one has to say.
Right.
And you click on that one. 3 hours later, you still haven't done anything, but you've got all this information. And the problem now is you've got five different ways to produce a podcast, but you're overwhelmed. And there's a book called The Paradox of Choice by Barry Schwartz, which is very interesting. And he talks about how you would think that when you have more options, that would give you more power, but actually it gives you less power. So a classic example would be if you, they did an experiment where they had dresses. They had a dress and they offered, you know, 50 different colors of this one dress, right? Because they wanted to give as many options as you can. If you tell a woman, take my wife, you say to her, here's a dress. And these are all the different colors you could choose from. You would think, wow, that's amazing. Look at all the options. But actually what happens is they get so overwhelmed by the choice that they don't take any action. They just walk away. I just can't choose. But if you said, here's three options, you've got black, white, and red, pick one. Suddenly the chances of them buying that dress goes sky high because you've limited the options.
Yeah.
The same thing here. We live in a generation where there's so much information out there. So you would think more people would be getting more things done, but actually the opposite has happened. We're getting so overwhelmed by all the information that we're doing less.
Yeah, I agree with that perception and aware of that, the social psychological research, I think. Where that's come out, and it's certainly been adopted in the world of marketing and market research, that we're not good at handling too many choices.
Yeah.
I'm interested in the whole podcast thing, clearly, because you're a podcaster. I'm a podcaster. By the way, when I started podcasting, there were no videos on YouTube to draw upon because it just hadn't really happened yet. And in your book, you advocate for podcasting. You recommend that your readers, hey, if you want to be a successful person in your business, be a podcaster.
Right.
So, how did you come to podcasting?
So what's interesting actually is, so for, I'll answer your question about how I got into podcasting, but I've actually come to a different realization as times has evolved, and also as I've evolved as a person, is I realized that you're actually better off getting on other people's podcasts than starting your own. And I'll explain that as well. So I actually got started in podcasting purely by mistake. Well, not mistake, but it was by chance. Someone randomly called me up and asked me to come on their podcast. This is 4 years ago. I had no idea what a podcast was. I was like, what's a podcast? And they had to explain to me what a podcast was. Yeah. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. You know, this high school class clown trying to get attention and getting in trouble, you know, instead of attention, I was getting detention, right? And here I am now being invited to speak. Like, wow, that's never happened to me before. This is amazing. And so next thing I know, I'm wearing a headset and I'm in my, you know, in my house in Israel, basically in my pajamas because, you know, there's nobody there. And I'm just talking and sharing like I am now. And first of all, I loved it. I realized that it came naturally to me to be able to just speak off the cuff because I didn't prepare for that show. I wasn't prepared. I didn't know what he was going to ask me, nor am I prepared for this show. Pretty much all the podcasts that I go on, I do not want to know the questions they're going to ask me because I like to be totally off script. Sure. I like to be raw and in the moment. So I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I had no idea how many people were listening, though. You know, in my mind, you know, maybe there was 10 or 20 people listening to this thing. You know, who knows? So when I asked the host, you know, how many people were listening to that, he said, oh, well over 1,000 people. Now, I almost fell off my chair because I can't believe there's no way 1,000 people were listening to me. There's no way. Where are these? Where are all these people? And he started listing countries like Canada, America, you know, Australia, Japan, yeah. China. I was like, what? You're telling me there's over 1,000 people that were listening to me all over the world, and I'm here in my pajamas in Israel. This is crazy. That's when I realized this podcasting stuff is very powerful. This is
powerful tool. That's available to anybody.
Yeah. It's incredible. And I realized, like, I didn't even leave my house. I didn't travel anywhere. I didn't go on stage. This was amazing. And so first thing I did was I said, okay, that's it. I'm going to start my own podcast because this is too much fun, right? This is just, you know. Within 2 weeks, I had my own show. I called it Can I Pick Your Brain, which is still going. It's been 4 years now. We're at 160-something episodes. And I basically, you know, interview, like you said, you know, successful entrepreneurs. Now, at the time, I didn't really know any successful entrepreneurs. I just kind of, you know, knew a couple of people in the business world. And so I started interviewing a few people I knew. And then because the podcast just took off and more people were listening to podcasts, I ended up interviewing 3 billionaires. I interviewed the smartest man alive. I interviewed the leading hostage negotiator for the FBI. Just so many different people from different walks of life with such incredible stories. And I couldn't believe I was speaking to them because I was this, you know, sort of this nobody who didn't know anybody. And now suddenly I'm a somebody. Yeah. And I, you know, grew it to 250,000 downloads. And then I realized the power of leveraging other people's audiences. Because what happened was at the beginning, it was very hard to grow my audience because I didn't know how to get listeners. Like, how do you, you know, it's great that you're delivering great content, right? But how do you get people to see your content? And I became obsessed with that question.
Particularly which is, now, there's like 400,000 podcasts, I think is the most.
800,000.
It's growing rapid. It's going up asymptotically.
Yes. 800,000 podcasts currently active, and there are over 100 million Americans listening to podcasts.
Wow.
Which is just incredible.
Over here, everybody, over here.
Yeah. So how do you get people to come and whether it's read your book or listen to your podcast or watch your videos or find your website, you know, how do you get people's attention? Remember me as the high school kid craving the attention and trying to figure out how do I get people's attention?
Right.
So, well, I discovered it. And that was through podcasting. Because when you go on other people's podcasts, you don't need to create your own audience. You leverage other people's audiences.
Yeah.
So that, and that's the key. You know, in real estate, the key is the, is how do you leverage other people's money? All the great real estate tycoons will tell you that the way that they built their wealth was by leveraging other people's wealth, essentially. And so in my world, which is the attention world, my what I do for a living, essentially, is I help people get attention. That's what I do for a living now. I started my own podcast booking agency, which is where we get our clients booked on podcasts as guests. We put them on top rated podcasts. Now, the reason why, how I discovered that was because when I started getting on other people's podcasts, my downloads started going up. More and more people started listening to my show because they were listening to that show. And then they said, oh, wow, I didn't know this person has a podcast. I'd love to listen to his podcast because they just listened to me for, you know, 30 minutes or an hour. And they want to now find out more. And so they go and they, and so what I say to people is that you can be very talented, right? You have a talent that you have. You could be the greatest writer in the world. You could be the greatest musician. You could be the greatest actor, actress. But if nobody knows about it, if nobody knows about you, then you don't exist, essentially. Your book doesn't exist. The best written books don't exist if we've never read them, if we don't know about them.
Right. Right.
And yet there are people who are singers or you know, who between me and you can't sing. They're not that talented. Yeah. But they know how to get an audience. And so we've heard about them and they're everywhere. And so my goal is to get the people who are extremely talented but don't know how to get the exposure and get them the exposure that they deserve.
Yeah, interesting concept. Why I'm contacted by publicists all the time who are trying to get their author onto the show. And it sounds like you've created a business where you're a publicist specifically targeting podcasts.
Correct. And I do it differently to what a lot of the publicists that you're probably getting pitched by.
And how is
well.
That? Yeah. What's your special sauce?
My special sauce is I understand what people want from a podcast. Your typical publicist, they understand numbers. They understand statistics and numbers. And that's how they are traditionally, you know, that's how they work. So, for example, in TV, radio, print, all they talk about is the reach, how much reach you can get. Now, we'll get you in front of 100 million eyeballs. Or we'll get you in front of, you know, 20 million, you know, readers. And they don't care about the actual readers or the people watching. They just care about the number of people. When I used to get pitched by the PR agencies, the ones that are pitching you, I would also turn away 99% of them because they were all treating me like I'm a number. Oh, if we send, you know, 200 emails to 200 podcasts hosts, you know, maybe we'll land five. So I was just a statistic to them. And I knew that because their emails were templated.
Sure.
They were cold. They didn't have a relationship with me. They didn't do research on my show. They clearly didn't really understand their client, because if they did, they would know that my show wasn't necessarily the right fit for their client. And if they did understand their client, they didn't do a very good job of representing them because they were boring. And so as a publicity agent, you should make your, you know, client sound interesting, or at least bring out the interesting parts, right, or the story that they have. And so about 2 years ago, I had this light bulb moment where I said, well, hold on a second, you know, if all these PR agencies and publicity agents are doing it wrong, well, why don't I start my own booking agency? Because number one, I'm a host, so I understand the podcast space. These PR agencies, they don't know because they don't have their own shows. I know the podcast space because I've interviewed over 160 guests on my show, and I've been a guest on over 60 shows. Number two, I've got the connections already, personal connections, because I've built relationships with other top-rated podcast hosts without having an agenda, because I didn't have a PR agency or a publicity agency when I started out. I was just another podcast host networking with other podcast hosts. So I've got the relationship, I've got the knowledge, the insider knowledge, and I understand human nature, which is people are not listening to podcasts to be sold to. They're listening to podcasts because they want to be educated and they want to be entertained.
Yeah.
That's it. And when you realize that, then if you can get your client, or if you can, as a person, entertain people and educate them at the same time through very powerful storytelling and creating a very powerful message with a hook at the end, which is your sell, whether it's a book or whether it's a course or whether it's a, you know, whatever it is that you're selling, then that's the secret sauce, essentially. Because when you know how to engage and connect with people, you don't need to sell, because they're already sold.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's about time. It generally, these interviews go about an hour, and I think we're already there. It's hard to believe.
Hard to believe, yes.
Yeah. When it goes well, it's hard to believe. Is there anything more that you'd like to say about your book, about your business, et cetera? You want to steal my audience? This is your chance.
This is my chance to take your audience. Well, I mean, Geffen Media Group is the agency that I run. Geffen is with one F. So they can go to geffenmediaagency.com if they want to engage and talk to me about getting exposure. My book is called The Self-Help Addict on Amazon. And the show, my podcast show, if they want to listen to my interviews with successful entrepreneurs, is called Can I Pick Your Brain?
Yeah. Well, thank you for giving me a chance to pick your brain here.
Thank you so much.
It's been delightful. And thanks for being my guest today.
My brain was happy to be picked.
Daniel Geffen was fascinating to speak with. I knew he was in Israel, and I had listened to a bit of one of his podcasts, but that was some time back, and so I had forgotten that he had a British accent, thus my gaffe in initially calling him an American. I've gotten way overbooked in terms of lining up guests months ahead. I don't like doing that because it seems to lead to a variety of mistakes, of which that faux pas was one. However, I'm besieged by so many people who want to be guests and others who are being promoted by publicists. It can be hard to say no. In fact, that's how Daniel and I got together for this interview. He's the founder of a new company he's calling the Geffen Media Group. He first reached out to me via email saying he had listened to some episodes of Shrink Wrap Radio and that he could book guests who would be a perfect fit for my show. I was somewhat intrigued, but clearly am not hurting for a lack of guests. Nevertheless, we corresponded back and forth, and at some point he suggested himself as a potential guest. I saw that he had an impressive list of personalities that he'd interviewed on his show and had written a self-help book, so he seemed like a good candidate. Plus, I've since realized there was a bit of a halo effect going on because of his last name being Geffen. I thought, this guy is really famous. Turns out I was thinking of David Geffen, who's a big wig in the Disney Corporation. Duh. When much later I got around to his self-help addict book, I discovered that it was strongly slanted toward helping people get past self-limiting beliefs and habits that get in the way of their financial success. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's just that there are tons of podcasts about that, and it's never been a focus of Shrink Wrap Radio. As we got into our conversation, I realized that I had stereotyped him and needed to shift levels. I found myself really admiring his ability to be self-examining, as well as to be open and self-disclosing about his human frailties. He shared that he was a big show-off and class clown in his early years of school. Sometime later, he realized that people were laughing at him rather than with him. And he's not blind to the dynamic that podcasting has offered him a healthier and more effective way to channel that same impulse. I liked that self-awareness and quickly began to suspect that he had had some personal psychotherapy. Lots of therapy, as it turns out, and that puts him dead center in being an appropriate guest for Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm sure it's because of my own issues around money that I particularly appreciated his story about having been turned off to the pursuit of money by his father's nervous obsession with it. Again, Daniel's inner witness brought him to the awareness that he needed to transmute his out-of-control feelings about money to tame them like taming a wild horse. And, of course, the father and grandfather in me resonated to his story about writing his book as a gift for his son's 10th birthday. Not only was that a self-motivational tool, but it also communicated a special caring to his son. The book is also a gift to all of us. Once again, the title is The Self-Help Addict: Turn an Overdose of Information into a Life of Transformation.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Jason. I want to say thank you. Your program has been a wonderful resource for me, getting to hear from people of diverse backgrounds, beliefs, and practices. Robert Hodea in particular resonates with me. Also Richard Katz, Monica Wickman, Alexander Schester, just to name some. But really, the stories and insights shared by you and all of your guests, as well as hearing from supporters, have all been gifts. So thank you to all of you. The lessons and practices I've learned from research and teachers, as well as powerful experiences, have been integral in my own path through anxiety and depression and unveiling the mystery that is myself and the conditions within and around me. And I've decided it would be most meaningful for me to help others in their healing, growth, and transformation, to become truer versions of themselves and find meaning in their lives. So I've made it my intention to apply to graduate school and become a therapist. And part of that intention is giving back to those who support me. So thank you for the insights and the guidance. Though I don't have much in the way of monetary resources, I decided that it's important for me to support you in Shrink Wrap Radio. So to any of your listeners considering making a contribution, I encourage you to do so and would ask how much you are willing to expend on a good book or making a nice meal for a loved one. Dr. Dave, your openness, curiosity, and humility come through in your talks, and I appreciate the gifts you bring me and others through the work you do. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. That tribute and encouragement makes my day. I'm happy to report that we have some new donors, including listeners renewing their annual donations. So thanks to Eric Bichara, thanks to Mitch at Premium Horizons, thanks to Carol Agrimonson, thanks to Mark Lange, and finally, thanks to Meredith Pitt. So with that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. And thanks to today's guest, Daniel Geffen of the Media Group, for allowing me to pick his brain about his book, The Self-Help Addict: Turn an Overdose of Information into a Life of Transformation. Next week, my guest will be Shannon Weber, MSW, author of Show Up Hard, A Roadmap for Helpers in Crisis. Shannon leads efforts to end HIV by day and hangs anonymous love notes in public spaces with her three teenagers by night. She's a serial social entrepreneur, having launched several HIV-informed sexual and reproductive health initiatives that have served thousands locally and impacted tens of thousands around the globe. And as if that's not enough, you can also find her TEDx presentation on YouTube. You definitely won't want to miss this one. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.